industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Dr. Abigail Kearns is an assistant professor in emergency medicine at the University of West Virginia and a medical toxicologist at the Blue Ridge Poison Center. Thank you so much, Dr. Kearns. Please take it away.
Great. Thanks so much for that introduction. So Hawk's Nest Tunnel, built in the 1930s, it represented one of the most impressive engineering feats of its time. Unfortunately, it's also remembered as one of America's worst industrial accidents. Photos up here, all taken from West Virginia. The one on the left and then top right, these are of the New River Gorge with the New River running down the middle of it. Bottom right photo is a little bit more personal. That's from the capital, Charleston, West Virginia. And this is actually taken off my father's dock on the Kanawha River. So we'll be talking about all of these rivers and how they pertain to the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster. Just a note, that bottom right river, as you notice, really flat, really great for learning to water ski, learning to wakeboard, not so great for harnessing hydroelectric power. So just to summarize what we'll be talking about today, the Hawk's Nest Tunnel was actually built as part of a larger hydroelectric project undertaken by the large company Union Carbide in the very small town of Golly Bridge, West Virginia. And construction of the tunnel took place between 1930 and 1931 over a 17-month period. Obviously, this was right around the time of the Great Depression. Construction of the tunnel required the work of nearly 3,000 men. 75% were Black individuals. And this really highlights some of the racial and discriminatory practices in the United States in the 1930s. These men endured prolonged exposure to silica dust without any forms of respiratory protection. And as a result, many went on to develop silicosis, both the acute and chronic forms of the disease. We'll never know exactly how many people died from the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster, but it is estimated around 1,000 deaths. So this is a beautiful photo of Golly Bridge, where our story will take place. So let's set the stage for the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster. So understanding the geography of this is actually pretty important to the larger story. So if you look at the map, we're going to start on the bottom right side where the New River flows up north and meets the Golly River, which flows south. And these meet in the town of Golly Bridge, West Virginia. These meet and they form the Kanawha River, which flows west to Charleston, that photo where my dad's dock was from. This is just an aerial photo of those. You see the Golly River on the left coming in, meeting the New River on the right and forming the Kanawha River. Some of you might be really familiar with the New River and New River Gorge. Proud to say, as of 2021, it is home to America's newest national park. And so as you can see in the photos, great area to go and do some cycling, some whitewater rafting. You see lots of elevation change in that water, right? So really good for whitewater rafting and hydroelectric power. And that'll be relevant to our story in a little bit. Let's take a step back. Let's go to Fayette County, where Golly Bridge is located in the 1930s. The 1930 population of Fayette County was only 70,000. It was 80% white, and the unemployment rate was about 30 to 40%, which is significantly higher than other parts of the country. As a result, people were desperate for any type of work possible. But our story really starts back with the formation of Union Carbide. Union Carbide was formed in 1917. In 1927, Union Carbide created the New Kanawha Power Company. Kanawha also being the name of the river, you know, that nice flat river that I showed you from my dad's dock. And it was a wholly owned subsidiary of Union Carbide. So why did Union Carbide create this subsidiary? If you go down the river, Union Carbide had a plant down the river. And this was a plant that smelted different ores to different ferroalloys of metals. And in order to do that, you need electricity to power those furnaces, right? And so one source of potential energy were those rivers that had this nice rapid elevation gains upstream. And so that was the purpose of this project, was to create a tunnel with a hydroelectric project going down and giving electricity to this plant. So Union Carbide came up with some plans. So if you look at the bottom right of the screen, this is where everything starts. They plan to build a dam. This would divert the water from the New River through a tunnel, which would be about 3 miles long, end up back in the New River. And as you can see, the tunnel would have about, like I said, 3 miles and a total elevation drop of 160 feet. And as you can see, these red L arrows represent different types of shafts, and each shaft would be a point of the start of construction, ultimately forming one large shaft. These are photos of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel today. This is a photo of the intake at the side of the mountain where water goes in and starts its 3-mile journey. And this is a photo of the other side of the dam over on the Hawk's Nest on Tam. These are photos of the turbines at the base when the water finishes its 3-mile journey. As you notice, not much changed in the one from the 1930s to the one today recently taken, minus the color in the photos. So while this was initially started as a hydroelectric project, Union Carbide quickly discovered that the samples that they were taking from the mountain actually contained high-grade silica. And just as a reference, coal contains about 2-3% silica. This silica was over 99% pure. So you might wonder, why did Union Carbide, you know, care that this contained silica? Interestingly, silica is used to make ferrosilicon, which is a component of steel. And so following this discovery, Union Carbide actually made plans to expand the tunnel from a 32-foot diameter to 45-foot diameter in order to mine this silica. And so with these plans in place, they knew what they wanted to do. They put the contract out for bidding. It was a really competitive bidding process, and there were about 35 bids. The lowest bid went to Reinhart and Dennis for $4.2 million, so a pretty good price for a project at that time. Reinhart and Dennis, actually from Charlottesville, Virginia, was a very reputable company. They had over 35 years of experience working on different tunnels, dams, and construction projects. So they really knew what they were doing. This was not an inexperienced company doing this project. Interestingly, the timeline of this project was very, very aggressive. Union Carbide wanted this project completed within 10 years. And when you think about the caliber of building a 3-mile tunnel, a dam, transmission lines, railroad, pretty ambitious, right? Reinhart and Dennis would actually receive $250 a day for every day that they completed early. However, if they went beyond the 2-year timeline, they had to pay Union Carbide $250 a day. Other interesting parts about the contract were that Reinhart and Dennis would assume all liability and thus shielding Union Carbide. And somewhat ironically, the contract also said that Reinhart and Dennis needed to furnish and equip an on-site hospital, but unfortunately the resources and time were never given to this and it was never completed. So where did the workers come for this big project? The majority of the 3,000 workers from the start to the end of the project were migrants from the South. Again, largely Black individuals, and this really highlighted some of the racial and discriminatory practices of the time. Many folks heard that there were good paying jobs in the North, and so they left their families and told them they would send money and come home when the jobs were done. However, they thought they were doing work in coal mining fields. So when they got up to West Virginia and found that they were actually working on a tunnel, which was much more dangerous and dirty work than they had thought they were doing, they really had pretty limited options given it was the 1930s and the working options were fairly limited. Working and living conditions were absolutely brutal for these workers. They did 60-hour work weeks. Sundays were their only days off. And pay actually started out pretty good. It was 50 cents an hour. Ultimately, the company decided to decrease the rates less and less to 30 cents an hour. And just for a comparison, most jobs in the South paid anywhere from 15 to 30 cents an hour. Again, highlighting the racial inequalities at this time. White workers were paid 5 cents an hour or more and were paid in cash, whereas Black workers received 5 cents less per hour and were paid in the form of scrip. They had to go to the company store to get the scrip turned into cash and pay the company Reinhart and Dennis a 10% fee to do so. All workers were also required to live on site. There were these really crudely built shacks that were very small and overcrowded. Sometimes 10 individuals would stay in a shack that was 12 by 14 feet. And sometimes they would actually rotate the same bed just depending on who worked what shift day or night. So certainly the company made some money from these. Additionally, these camps were segregated. The camps that the white workers lived in had electricity and camps that the Black workers lived in did not have electricity. In order to heat them, they had to use coal heaters, which they had to pay the company for the coal for. And again, somewhat ironically, they also had to pay a weekly fee for a company doctor and a local hospital. Conditions in the tunnel were equally brutal. The drilling of the tunnel, interestingly, was defined as a construction project. So this was a type of civil engineering project rather than being designated as a mining project. at the time, the mining industry was a very booming industry, and there were actually some protective provisions in place for miners. But since this was not a mining project, the workers of the Hawk's Nest Tunnel did not receive any benefits from these provisions. They did not receive any form of personal protective equipment, despite the fact that the company knew that there were large amounts of silica dust in the air. And this has been a disease that people have known about for probably about 100 years now. And this is really, really exemplified by the fact that when inspectors and the company men went in to inspect the tunnel, they knew to wear masks and personal protective equipment. So they were aware of the hazards. Additionally, there were no privies or washing facilities on site. So the cleanliness and hygiene aspects alone also were an issue. Again, work was segregated. So Black workers had the dirtiest and most dangerous jobs, which were the jobs deep inside the tunnel. The construction process was actually fairly straightforward. There were different techniques of drilling. Wet drilling was known to be safer, albeit slower, than dry drilling. However, the company opted to use just dry drilling since they could do four holes in the time it would take for them to drill one hole with a wet drilling technique. And so once the holes were drilled, they would put dynamite in the holes, and then the workers would evacuate and they would explode the dynamite. So as you can imagine, in these 30 to 40 foot tunnels, huge amounts of dust and debris falling. The most hazardous part for the individuals was when they returned after the explosions. Originally, they were supposed to take two-hour breaks after the detonations to allow dust to settle. But supervisors would typically force them to go in, typically 30 minutes after the detonations occur. Supervisors often would be equipped with pistols and resorted to violent methods to get people to go back in the tunnels and do work. So as you can imagine, the tunnel was filled with dust and debris. Workers could often not see more than an arm's length ahead of them, and they couldn't breathe. So kind of the biggest concept to take away was the poor ventilation and the lack of personal protective equipment. Eventually, the West Virginia Department of Mines did step in and say, okay, you have to install some form of ventilation. And so the company put in a 24-inch canvas fan with 24-inch canvas tube with an 18-inch fan. And so when you're thinking about 40-foot tunnel, here's a person for reference, that tiny little fan really is not going to do much to get that dust and debris out. Additionally, when you have a large amount of falling rocks, they're going to hit the canvas tube and they would collapse it, put holes in it. So really pretty ineffective against dust. Another work hazard was carbon monoxide. There were these little locomotives called dinkies that brought the debris out. And of course, these are going to form carbon monoxide. It was reported that on most shifts, anywhere from 12 to 16 workers had to be carried out after collapsing from carbon monoxide. And so they would be taken out to fresh air. They would be given ammonia in front of their faces. And once they woke up, they staggered back into work. This resulted in a really high worker turnover. Only 20% of people stayed on the job 6 months or more. Only 2% of workers worked from the beginning of a project to the end of its project just 17 months later. And so the town of Gauley Bridge became known as the town of the living dead. Many workers were too ill and too weak to keep working on the tunnel. And as a result, they got kicked out of the company housing since they couldn't afford to live there. But they stayed in the town, earning the town its name, Town of the Living Dead. So how many people do we think died in the Hawk's Nest Tunnel? If you look at the reports from Reinhart and Dennis, they say maybe 30 to 100, but the historic records show otherwise, probably more like about 1,000. Again, most of the deaths were in Black workers who had the most dangerous jobs in the tunnel. And very unfortunately, very few bodies were returned to families in the South. The company made little to no efforts to provide death certificates or contact the families of the workers. And those are just the casualties, right? And so many of the workers that actually stayed on for the job and didn't die immediately from silicosis left town and moved south. And when they died, their deaths never became part of the state record. Fast forward to the 1970s, when the U.S. Department of Highways was looking to expand U.S. Route 19, they came across some bones basically adjacent to where they wanted to do their work. And they knew what it was. They spoke to some local people. They dug the bones up and they basically discarded them in an abandoned lot where there were some appliances, trash, things like that. Nothing happened with the bones until 2012, where the bodies were located and the cemetery was created as it is today. So, brief talk, what is silicosis? Silicosis is pneumoconiosis, and it's due to inhalation of crystalline silica, a mineral found in many types of rocks, such as quartz. Of note, there are a lot of different types of silica, with the type of silica in gel packets, amorphous silica, generally being non-toxic. So I'm sure many of us have countertops made of silica products, right? Quartz, things like that. And so many occupations nowadays still have this risk. Mining, quarrying, tunneling. If you're driving, you see somebody sandblasting or grinding a sidewalk, hopefully you see them wearing personal protective equipment. Silicosis can present with a wide range of findings. Individuals might have shortness of breath. They might have heart failure. Imaging might show abnormalities on chest x-ray or CT scan. Lung function tests might show a restrictive lung pattern. And there's not a cure for silicosis, but providers can do their best to provide supportive care. Another important note is to remember that you need to screen for other diseases such as tuberculosis and cancer. And just a brief mention, there are different types of silicosis. The Hawk's Nest Tunnel really illustrated both types. Acute silicosis occurs after a massive exposure, with death occurring often within weeks to months. And chronic silicosis symptoms might not manifest until decades, and often due to a low level of chronic exposure. That is the more common form of exposure. And I would be completely remiss as a toxicologist if I didn't say the phrase eggshell calcifications, as on the right. So the Hawk's Nest Tunnel today. So the Depression Era project remains an engineering marvel. It still generates a large amount of electricity, the same as it did in the 1930s. This is a photo of Joe Manchin, the prior governor of West Virginia, on the site visit for the very first inspection that the dam and tunnel had in its 90 years. And overall, it looked great, did not require any significant renovations. And so as a West Virginian, I encourage everybody to go to West Virginia at least once. There are a lot of fun things to do. Photos on top left and bottom right are of the New River Gorge Bridge. If you are brave and not afraid of heights, you can actually walk across the bridge. But if you are really nerdy and want to try to impress your family or friends with your Tox nerdum history, you can drive not too far and show them the Hawk's Nest Tunnel, talk about the Hawk's Nest Tunnel disaster, and tell them all about silicosis, and I think they will be fairly impressed.